The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I'm excited to welcome back a writer who has appeared at the library many times during the past couple of decades. Mark Bowden is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and the best-selling author of 15 books of investigative journalism, among them Black Hawk Down, Killing Pablo, winner of the Overseas Press Club's Cornelius Ryan Award for Book of the Year, The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden, Guests of the Ayatollah, and Hue 1968, the story of the Vietnam War's bloodiest battle. He'll be joined in conversation this evening by co-author Matthew Teague, a former international and national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, whose writing has appeared in numerous anthologies, including Best American Travel Writing, Best American Crime Writing, and Best American Sports Writing. He is executive producer of the 2021 feature film, Our Friend, based on his National Magazine award-winning article, The Friend, in Esquire magazine. Their new book is The Steal, a week-by-week, state-by-state account of the attempt by Donald Trump and his allies to invalidate the results of the 2020 presidential election. Tonight, Mark and Matthew will be in conversation with Emmy award-winning journalist, broadcaster, and longtime friend of the Free Library of Philadelphia, Tracy Maddock. It's great to have you with us. Tracy, the screen is yours.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. Welcome, everyone. We're delighted that you're able to spend part of your evening with us, and we hope that you'll find this to be an enlightening conversation. Please do remember that we have budgeted some time for questions at the end, as Andy mentioned, so be sure to type in your questions, and we'll get through as many of them as we can. That said, Mark and Matthew, welcome back to, I should say, the Free Library. I know both of you have lived in Philadelphia, and Mark in particular, you've been here many times. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Tracy.
Mark, let me begin with you, because there are so many books about Trump's time in office, particularly the last few weeks and months. What is it about this book, The Steal, that is different from so many of the others that we've seen about that particular period of time?
Well, Matt and I, from the very beginning, realized that there would be a tremendous amount of attention focused on the events of January 6th and on the sort of the Trump administration and the people in Washington around him. But it seemed to us that the bigger story and the better story was the concerted effort that Trump made in the six swing states all over the country in the 2 or 3 months after the election, where, you know, he launched basically a three-pronged assault in these six swing states, including Pennsylvania, which took place on the popular front, in the political arena, in court, where he attempted to get the results of the 2020 election overturned. So we wanted to find the people who were really on the front lines of that struggle, both the activists who were trying to overturn the election and the local and state officials whose responsibility it was to make sure the votes were counted fairly and certified. So that's why we decided to do it this way. And I think it is a completely different, and I would argue, more important look at what actually happened after the election in 2020.
Speaking of those unsung heroes, Matthew, this question is for you. Most of us remember names like Brad Raffensperger, Gabe Sterling, because we saw quite a bit of them on the news in the weeks following the election. Fewer of us, though, would probably know Clint Hickman from Arizona, or some of the other names that you mentioned, Cheryl Guy, for instance. Can you tell us about, you know, a couple of those unsung heroes and what it was that they did that helped preserve the results of the election, the real results of the election?
Sure, I'll talk about the last one you mentioned, Cheryl Guy. She is a county clerk in Antrim County, Michigan, which is a pretty far-flung county in the state. And she is, as she says, she's not a tech-savvy person. And on election night, she made a mistake with the new software that she was working with. She shifted essentially a column of about 3,000 Trump votes to Biden. It was an accident. She herself is a Republican and voted for Trump. So one of the votes that she shifted was probably her own. And she realized within a few hours of what she had done, the mistake she had made. And she came forward and said, I've messed this up. It's just human error. I own this and I apologize and I've corrected it. But within that little window of time, sort of news of this mistake had rocketed around not just her county and not just Michigan, but the United States and the world, really. And so quickly there were private jets from the Trump-related team coming in the night, people coming into her office, sort of turning her life upside down, because they wanted to hold this up as an example of the election being rigged in some way. And she was crucial because in standing up and sort of taking the pain of admitting that she had made a mistake, what she did was sort of put a lie to all the claims that Trump was making. Because if everyone in the political world knew about what had happened in this far-flung county within a few hours of 3,000 votes, the alarm that would go up if, as Trump claimed, there really were hundreds of thousands of votes or even millions of votes, it would have been deafening. So she was an important person and she paid some personal cost for it. She lost friends over this.
Well, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that, because so many of these people paid a very high price for doing the right thing. You know, many of them were doxxed and so forth. Talk a little bit about that, Matthew, and the personal price that some of these people paid.
Well, some of them, you mentioned Brad Raffensperger. He's the Secretary of State of Georgia, and he had the President of the United States on the phone, famously leaning on him to find 11,000 votes to sort of swing the election Trump's way. Stood up to that and faces now a very difficult primary challenge from a Republican that Trump has endorsed. But really all the way down to the ground level, still there in Georgia, there's a lady named Ruby Freeman who was giving her time for little or no money to help count the ballots there in Georgia. And people sort of came up with very strange conspiracies about toilets overflowing and things in this the State Farm arena where she was working. And she sort of became this fictional character on the internet where people blamed her for a lot of these things and accused her of trying to sort of wheel in suitcases of Biden ballots and wheel out Trump ballots, all of which was complete balderdash. And it turned into harassment, people showing up on her doorstep late at night, frightening her. She's an older lady. And so it's a frightening thing. If you're interested in democracy, you know that we need people on the ground level administrating it.
Yeah. Mark, I want to come back to you because you mentioned Trump's three-pronged strategy, and you write at some length about that in the book. In fact, you say that democracy depends upon a modicum of trust. And then you proceed to outline this three-pronged strategy that Trump used to great effect to build distrust over time. Can you talk about that strategy and why it was so successful on so many levels?
Well, I think, you know, the popular pressure were the demonstrations that were arranged, were organized in the various states. In Arizona, for instance, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors had hundreds of people banging on the windows outside and chanting for them to be executed. Clint Hickman, who was the president of that board, had people, protesters on his front lawn of his house, harassment, threats. So that was sort of the popular effort. Then there was the political effort, which was to try to lean on Republican legislators and also election officials to refuse to certify the count. And instead of sending Biden electors to the Electoral College to send a slate of Trump electors, and they had a lot of state legislators, Republican around the country, who were willing to join that effort. In fact, even today, continue to propound these theories. And then you had the legal effort. 61 individual lawsuits were filed in the six swing states over those 2 months. And every single one of them lost. Also, every single one of the state officials refused to do what Trump wanted them to do. So the only part of it that really worked in a big way was the popular thrust. And we saw at the end with all the other failures, you know, Trump eventually summoned a mob to Washington and set them loose on the Capitol building.
Yeah. So on that front of the popular success that he enjoyed in terms of convincing people that there was, in fact, a steal here, Mark, there are a couple of people that you write about, and I want to zero in on two from Pennsylvania, from Delaware County. Since we are here in Philadelphia and Delaware County is part of our neighborhood, but you write about Leah Hoops and Greg Stenstrom in particular, two who were among many people who seemed to be convinced that there would be fraud in this election, and by gosh, they were not going to let it happen on their watch. Tell us a little bit about them and how they sort of reflected so many others across the country at election time.
Well, Leah Hoops, who lives in Chads Ford in Delaware County, is a woman who became politically active locally after Trump's election, or when Trump first ran for office. She was just very enthusiastic about Donald Trump. And so she believed going into the 2020 election that she believed what Trump said, which was that the only way he could lose would be if the election was stolen. And so she had actually formed an organization called the Pennsylvania Watchdogs, and she recruited Greg Stenstrom. And they showed up on election day in different capacities, but essentially they were there as observers. But in fact, what they were there doing is to try to spot the fraud that they were certain was taking place. And so they ended up at the counting center in Chester in Delaware County. And they ran into some flack there because they hadn't been initially authorized to observe at the main counting center. And then they were let in anyway. And once they were let in, they experienced what I call confirmation bias, which is what we use to describe scientists who get the results of the experiment that they want to get. So they saw what they wanted to see, and they interpreted everything that they were looking at, and this was a very big, complex operation. They interpreted what was going on as being the introduction of fake Biden ballots, and a huge scam was being perpetrated. And so they, you know, they were utterly convinced, and I think remain convinced to this day, even though there's absolutely no evidence in the voting record that anything like that happened.
Yeah. Matthew, the two of you write in the book about how so many of the actions of Trump's most radical supporters really were, you know, were not based on fact, obviously, but were based on vibes, on like they just had a gut feeling about something, kind of like Trump, right? The idea of trusting your gut above all else.
Yeah, I think that's the power of propaganda and disinformation, is that it doesn't seek to persuade people of something new and novel. It just reinforces what they really wanted to believe to begin with. And so when there's something before you that you really want to be true, it doesn't require much more than the vibes that you mentioned. It doesn't take facts particularly or argument. It just takes a little nudge. And that's Trump is a master of that.
Yeah. Mark, there is a whole chapter in the book called The Blunderbuss Strategy, which really the whole book is kind of about the blunderbuss strategy. What was that?
Well, the blunderbuss was a colonial era kind of precursor to the shotgun, which you could load anything into it, pebbles and glass and stones. And it wasn't accurate, but it blasted a lot of shot. And so I felt that was the appropriate analogy for the Trump's campaign's effort to essentially collect every allegation of fraud that surfaced, everything from the person who was claiming that the voting machines had been pre-programmed to switch votes, to Greg Stenstrom in Delaware County saying that fake Biden ballots had been inserted into the count, from the woman Lenny Stone in Arizona who said she saw the signature of Satan in the spreadsheets of election results. And no matter how silly or easily debunked these fraudulent claims were, Rudy Giuliani and his team of lawyers in these six states seized upon everything and threw it all out there. And so I called it the blunderbuss strategy because it wasn't really meant to be accurate. I don't think that they believed that any of these claims they could actually prove or would stand up in court. And in fact, none did. But I think the theory was if you threw up enough of them, if you blasted enough shot, even reasonable people looking at it might say, well, gee, maybe there was something wrong with the election just because there's so many people who are claiming fraud.
Yeah. One of the alarming things that has come out of all of this is that some of the same people who worked so hard to try to change the election results in Trump's favor are now sort of sharpening their sword, if you will, and thinking ahead, obviously, to 2024. And certainly the former president and a lot of his allies are working to insert a lot of these people into positions of power within the whole election system across the country to be prepared for next time. And Matthew, I'd like you to talk about that, about what we might see in the next 2 years as Trump works to try to insert some of these people in positions where maybe they could change the outcome the next time.
Well, a couple of things. One is that is a very real threat. That's why we chose to focus on everything leading up to January 6th, even more than the day itself. It's because that's where I believe, and Mark believes, the true insurrection really started. And so that there is a threat of that. On the other hand, I would say that one of the strengths of our system of election is that it's decentralized. It's diffused throughout the country. There's not one building where Trump or anyone else could install a person to overthrow things. It's administrated in the counties and the towns where we live, and it's run by our neighbors and friends, people we go to church with, we work with, things like that. And so it will take more than just a handful of figures to overthrow an American election, but it's certainly something to be paid attention to.
And Mark,
I would also, could I add something to that, Tracy?
Sure.
I think that because so much of the popular movement claiming that the election was stolen was really based on ignorance. I mean, many people who are out there protesting have no experience in running an election. They have no idea how complex and difficult it is to collect millions of votes. Every one of these counties, sometimes from precinct to precinct, there's different rules and regulations. There are different machines. I mean, this is almost like a biannual miracle that we managed to hold these elections. So I think that it's very easy to stand outside a building and hold up a sign and claim that the system is corrupt. But when you are actually working there, when you're working alongside your neighbors, counting the votes and moving them, and you become steeped in the mechanics of the process, I think then it becomes, unless you're a thoroughly dishonest human being, it becomes very difficult to make these completely baseless claims that somehow the election is being rigged.
Is there a concern, though, Mark, that there would be a sort of great resignation among those people who did do the right thing, who paid such a heavy price that you all just talked about a moment ago, that many of those people would say, you know what, it's just not worth it, and that we would be vulnerable to people who maybe wouldn't be willing to take that stand. So I wonder what your thoughts are about whether we might be losing some of the people who kind of kept everything intact the last time.
Well, I think we will. We will lose some of the people for whom volunteering to work on an election site or for some of these local offices is not a very glamorous job. It doesn't pay. There's very little excitement associated with it. It's tedious work for the most part. And so some of the people who became the focus of all of this anger and all of these threats were intimidated and have backed out of it. But my feeling is that just as many people will see that these jobs are really important and under contest or under threat. And so my feeling is that as many people, if not more, will step up because the occasion demands it. And I hope that's true. And so although we'll lose some of the people who did it the last time, I think we may actually attract more people to this process.
I want to ask both of you about a recent poll, an NPR poll, and you may have heard about this, that indicates that 64% of Americans believe that democracy is at risk of failing, and the sentiment is most strongly felt among Republicans, two-thirds of whom, according to this poll, believe that voter fraud helped Joe Biden to win the election. So there's bipartisan agreement that democracy in danger, but for completely different reasons. I wonder, what are we to make of that and what does that portend? And Matthew, I'll start with you, and then Mark, I'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
I'm sorry, I lost you for just a second there. Could you say that the last?
Sure, just that I wanted to know your thoughts about this NPR poll. 64% of Americans believe democracy is at risk of failing, but most of them are Republicans who believe that there was voter fraud and that that's what allowed Joe Biden to win. So the question is that while there's, you know, bipartisan agreement that democracy is in danger, it's for completely different reasons. And
right.
What do we make of that?
Well, I would say that I wouldn't put entirely too much stock in some of those polls. If you had surveyed Democrats after Trump's win, many of them might have said in 2016 that he was also illegitimately elected. It's more worrisome that so many Republicans say that violence is a possibility that may be necessary. But more importantly than all of those things, I would say that these are short-term strategies. These are not going to be winning strategies over time in a representative system. Only the party that provides policies that appeal to the majority of the populace are going to succeed in time. So I think things like threats of violence, it's dangerous and frightening, but I don't think that will provide any long-term sort of threat.
Mark, what do you say?
Well, I think that the real danger here is the loss of trust. Our society politically has become so partisan that it used to be that if you lost an election, you were disappointed, but you didn't claim that the opposing party had cheated and stolen the election from you. And so I think that, you know, to have a democracy, you have to depend on majority rule. And the only way to determine a majority is through a vote. So you really, in order to have a democracy, have to have a modicum of trust in the winning side that they will conduct an honest counting of the votes. So as long as people continue to doubt their neighbors, because they're the ones doing the counting, and refuse to believe that they have the integrity to run an honest vote, I really do think that this is a cornerstone of the way democracy works.
So you mentioned the way that we view each other and distrusting our own neighbors. And I wanted to ask you about that because you write in the book about Cheryl Hoops and her view that her Democrat neighbors were not just fellow citizens with a different opinion, but they were un-American subversives who could not be trusted. And then you also write that the corresponding view among Democrats, many of them, is that their Republican neighbors are, and I'm quoting here, racist, ignorant, xenophobic, and determined to impede the popular vote. I guess a couple of questions come out of that. One is about how we overcome some of these visceral biases that we've developed toward one another. But I guess the first question is, in writing the book, Mark, was at least some part of the design to maybe help us see each other in a different light? The fact that you chose Republicans who were Trump supporters, who did the right thing and stood up to all of the pressure, was there on some level an effort to help us maybe begin to see each other in a different light?
I would say yes. And, you know, it wasn't as specific, Tracy, as you describe it there. But, you know, it's a goal of mine in every work of journalism I do. It's one of the reasons why I believe journalism is so important. And that is that we need to understand each other. We need to understand how and why things happen the way they do. We need to understand people like Leah Hoops. You know, we need to understand why she is so angry and so motivated to do what she does. And, you know, I think that the better we understand each other, the better chance we have of respecting each other. And so, you know, yes, and I, you know, in answer to, you know, finding Republicans, neither Matt nor I actually expected when we began this project that we'd end up with these sort of profiles in Courage from Republican officials around the country. That's just what we found. And I think it's really not that much of a surprise, because swing states are swing states because elections are really close in those places. So some of those states are run by Democratic officials and some are run by Republican officials. All of the elections are overseen by bipartisan panels of Republicans and Democrats. So, you know, what we discovered was the greatest pressure that was being put on people was being put on Republicans, because they were the ones, I think, who the Trump campaign felt they could influence.
Matthew, what do you think it will take to overcome the kinds of biases that we have developed? I mean, there has always been partisanship, but, you know, I don't have to tell you about the level of polarization that we're looking at in this country where no one can agree on anything. What do you think that it will take to overcome that and maybe to begin to listen and to see each other in a different light?
That's a big question. I think, you know, a couple of things that could help. For instance, you know, Mark referred to the difference between Republicans who are sort of going along with the big lie and those who are standing up against it. And what we found was that the people who were standing up against it were the people who were involved in the process, who were helping run these elections or just observe elections or count ballots or whatever their participation was. They had firsthand experience. They had the facts before them, such that when the disinformation started to come in from Washington, they were able to recognize it and say, hold on a second, I'm not going to go along with that. That's not true. And so I think when citizens participate and they gain a little bit better understanding of the way the system works, it gives them some immunity against the propaganda that we're sort of subjected to now daily. So I think that would be a great help. Another thing would be, I think, transparency. I think there was a lot of confusion about how elections work. It's different from state to state and even county to county. Confusion about what's Congress's role, what's official, what's ceremonial. And so I think transparency is always helpful in these circumstances.
Yeah. Along those lines, and Mark, I'll direct this to you. There was among the many reviews of your book, the one in the New Republic said, and I'm going to quote here, no other advanced democracy, indeed, not even many developing ones, experiences anything like the problems of our chaotic locally administered system. He further says, and I'm quoting again, the American electoral system itself, in which the national popular vote decides neither the presidency nor control of the legislature, is almost perfectly designed to exacerbate disorganization and doubt. So the question is, do you agree with that assessment? And if so, is it time for us to maybe rethink the way that we do elections, maybe to have a more standardized way of carrying them out, at least on the national level?
Well, I think really one of the things that I learned, and Matt and I both learned working on this book, was that while some of the things that are said in that review I think are true, what's also true is that it makes it extremely difficult to pull off any kind of a big fraudulent campaign. I mean, you can't change that many votes in America precisely because the voting system is so tremendously decentralized. Could it be streamlined? Could there be more uniform rules and regulations? Could we all use the same voting machines? I think those kinds of things would probably increase the efficiency of elections, but I think we need to guard against doing something like creating a federally, centrally administered national election, because I think we would be throwing out one of the real strengths of the American electoral system.
Matthew, in light of, you know, January 6th and all that has happened since, we've been watching the January 6th committee as it is speaking with many, many people and issuing subpoenas. I think there was a new one today. I believe it was for Mark Meadows, perhaps, or was it Kevin McCarthy today? But I'm just curious what your thoughts are about where this will end up ultimately. They're rushing to get through this with the midterms coming up. And I wonder what you think the outcome will be and whether there might be some accountability for the former president and others.
Well, that's difficult to answer, but I think the more transparency, the better, as I mentioned. I think the more we know about what happened and who led it, the better we are. My hope is that the hearings will not center merely on sort of palace intrigue. Where was Trump himself, physically from moment to moment throughout January 6th, and expand that inquiry into what happened around the country, what happened in Detroit, what happened in Georgia, what happened in Philadelphia, et cetera. Because as we've mentioned, I think that's where the real power of this insurrection really started to gather.
Yeah. Mark, has Donald Trump lost any meaningful level of support? And I ask that because of the disillusionment that we hear about. I mean, not only the people that you write about who paid a very heavy price for doing the right thing with the election, but even people who were part of January 6th, who felt betrayed by the former president, felt that he was going to be with them and that he wasn't. Is there any significant or meaningful loss of support, or is his support as strong as it ever was at this point?
Well, I think one thing we've learned in modern times is not to underestimate Donald Trump's political strength. But I do think that that his support has eroded. We saw that in the 2020 election. I think, frankly, one of the reasons that Trump lost in 2020 was because he convinced so many Republican voters not to vote by mail. And we know that that really hurt him. I mean, that was one of the reasons why some of the Republican officials in Wisconsin attracted the ire of the Trump officials prior to the election, because they were dismayed that the president was trying to tell Republicans not to vote by mail. I think that really hurt him. So, I think too that, you know, January 6th was such an outrage and such a shameful incident. I can't believe that any other than a tiny fraction of people would somehow believe that wasn't Trump supporters that attacked the Capitol building. I mean, my God, they pretty much documented it second by second all by themselves and came home and bragged about it. So, I mean, I just think that has to have turned off many voters. And I think these public hearings that are coming up will lay out exactly how cynical, you know, this effort was to basically overturn the cornerstone of our democratic system.
Yeah. On that note, let me go to some questions from our audience, because I see they are beginning to stack up here. So let's see what we've got. Deborah asks, in your opinions, so we'll direct this to both of you, what can we best do? And I know, Matthew, you've talked about transparency here, but what can we best do to keep this from happening again? Mark, why don't you start on that one?
Well, I think that the first thing I would say to that question is we should be fairly heartened by the fact that none of these state and local officials who came under all this pressure buckled and did the wrong thing. None of the 61 lawsuits that were filed, many of them heard before Republican judges, some of them appointed by Trump, none of them succeeded. In fact, in many of these cases, judges excoriated the lawyers for even bringing such flimsy cases into their courtroom. Where I would like to see an effort made is to protect the people who are working on elections. So far, to my knowledge, no one has been prosecuted for the harassing and threatening of people like Ruby Freeman, who were just doing their civic duty on election day. And I think that these people who volunteer in many cases to come out and conduct our elections need to be protected. And the other thing that I think needs to happen is we need to make very clear if it's not clear enough in the law, that what the responsibility of state legislatures are to certify the electoral count, that that has to be the actual vote. And once those electors are sent to Congress, you know, to eliminate the possibility that they can somehow be replaced for political reasons, you know, by a losing candidate.
Matthew, anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think those are all good points. One small thing I would add is that so much of the disinformation, the propaganda that blasted across the country, and I've seen it even among my own loved ones, comes from easily digested news bits on TV. And since we're at a library here tonight, I'm always heartened when I hear of people who read their news and try to get a broad variety of it. I think that can really give you tools against disinformation.
Yeah. Stephen says, Rachel Maddow has reported that in 5 or 6 swing states, that there were false slates of Trump electors submitted claiming to be the true electors sworn and notarized. The documents were substantially similar. Are you aware of where this conspiracy originated? So I'll throw that out to either one of you.
Well, I think it originated in the Trump White House. I don't really think, frankly, Rudy Giuliani was well organized enough to pull off a plot like that. But clearly, I mean, we saw it happening in Wisconsin, where there was the Trump, what would have been the Trump electors. The way the election works is if Trump had won the election, then certain people from various precincts around the country or districts would send a Trump elector to Madison where they would be certified, and then they would be sent to Washington as the electors from the state of Wisconsin. Of course, Biden won the election, but the people who would have been Trump electors convened in Madison anyway on the same day that the state legislature and the governor authorized or certified the Biden electors. They held their own meeting and had plans to go to Washington. Now, the only way that they could have accomplished anything is if somehow, you know, the Congress had decided to throw out the legitimately elected electors and throw the, you know, vote back to Congress. Then Congress would have basically a political brawl to determine whether they would choose the Trump electors or the Biden electors. So that's why I say that we need, I hope, in the next year or so, I hope, and this it seems to me ought to be a bipartisan thing, because these kind of games and schemes could be played by either party. I think that we need to make sure that the actual vote is certified, that the electors who are sent to Washington represent the actual vote in that state. And we need to make that very clear and difficult to tamper with.
Yeah. James asks, there's a few questions here. In view of your work, what do you think about current ongoing efforts by Republican state legislatures, including here in Pennsylvania, not simply to change voting laws, but to transfer authority over elections from state and local election officials to state legislatures? I ask particularly in view of departing U.S. Senator Patrick Toomey's recent op-ed in the Inquirer that Democratic, whether capital D or small d, concerns about voter suppression are unfounded. Mark, I'll start with you, and Matthew, you chime in if you'd like as well.
Well, I think that the effort to stack the vote and to involve state legislators in determining, you know, who the slate of electors will be are all part of the very unnecessary confusion over how we count votes and how we certify them. And that's why I say I think it's so critically important. I mean, state legislators should have absolutely no role in certifying election results other than a ceremonial one. This is a count. It's done, you know, and it's verifiable. There are paper records, there are digital records. So, I mean, once the vote has been entered and counted, the only role that I see, appropriate role for the state legislature, is to certify that this was an honest election, this is the way the people voted, and we will act accordingly. Anybody who's trying to do something different than that, which Trump did, in 2020, and he failed, I think should, they're basically trying to undermine the way democracy is supposed to work. So I would hope we would be able to stop it.
And Matthew, since we were talking about voter registration, and certainly there's been an awful lot of discussion around that, as so many states across the country have made it more difficult for people to vote. And the Biden administration has faced accusations that it has just not done enough to try to move the needle on that. I wonder if you would share your thoughts about that and how optimistic you are that we may be able to make progress in terms of either overturning those votes or not making voting so difficult in so many parts of this country.
Well, I think that this goes a little beyond the scope of what we address in the book, but I think that generally the fight is always going to be Republicans trying to sort of restrict the number of people who vote. It's better for them. And Democrats are going to be pushing to have more open, expansive voting. And as to who's going to win that fight, it's very difficult for me to predict. Personally, I tend to lean toward making sure that everyone has a chance to vote and do it in a way that does guard against fraud and things like that. But as we've established in the book, it's just not there. That fraud that's being alleged, that's being held up as, we need more restriction, it's just not happening. It's just not true.
Dorothy asks, she says, Mark mentioned that sometimes it's easy to stand outside a building and hold up a sign. Can you speak to the importance of emailing or phoning elected representatives on important issues such as voting rights? So I will direct that to you, Mark.
Well, I think that is a way that people can get involved, and that's important. I think you should let your elected representatives know what you think. And I think they do probably pay attention because it's an indication of how their policies or what they're saying are playing among their among the people they represent. So I think that's one of those basic citizenship tools that we all have. And the more people who use them, the better.
Yeah. Frederick has a couple of questions here about, those who have believed the big lie. And kind of the bottom line question is, what do you do with that? And how do you, is it possible to convince people who have bought into the big lie of what the truth really is? I'll leave that to either of you. How do we go about, turning that around?
Well, I think, in fact, some of that is already turning around. And maybe I'm being overly optimistic, but I would have to think that a lot of sensible people who bought the idea that the election was stolen would understand that if it was going to be an effective steal, it had to take place in places like Maricopa County, Arizona, which is a hugely important swing state. Maricopa County is Phoenix, Arizona, where 90%+ of all the votes in Arizona go. So that was one of the places that was pivotal. And we saw what happened. I mean, the election was counted fairly. The right electors were certified, but then the state has conducted several forensic audits of its election, including the one by Trump supporters with the announced purpose of proving that Trump had actually won in Arizona. And even they ended up determining that not only did Biden win, but that he had been undercounted somewhat. So, I mean, I think that when you see something like that happen, all but the most absolutely zealous, Trump supporters would have to say, well, it looks like, this election was conducted fairly.
I think some of it may be regional, because as a Southern resident, I'm not quite as optimistic as Mark. Maybe I live among more zealous people. And I think that a slow change may happen as people sort of read books like ours, hopefully, and confront facts. But that a lot of it may be a matter of a new crop of voters coming in and sort of generationally changing things with more savvy about the way information is transmitted on the internet, where to place value on that information and where it comes from. Maybe people can do it quickly, but I'm less optimistic on that front.
Well, Charles asks the question that I'm sure most of us are asking as we think about the next few years, and that is, what's the likelihood that Trump runs in 2024? Mark, what do you say?
I would say if he's breathing, he's running. I lives for attention. Is probably deeply wounded that he was turned out of the White House. In fact, he said as much, and he believes it was unfair. So yeah, I think he's definitely going to run. And frankly, I think if he runs, this is going to make for a real bloodbath within the Republican Party, because right now it's going on where the party is telling candidates in various states who want the party's backing in a run for office, that they'll only support them if they'll say that Trump really won in 2020. So, this is going to become a real showdown in the Republican Party. And frankly, if Trump runs, it may end up being the best possible scenario for Joe Biden or whatever Democratic candidate is running, because it's going to, I think, seriously split the Republican Party.
There is this school of thought that says that maybe he wants to just be a kingmaker, that the prospect of possibly losing again is just so unattractive that he would prefer to be the kingmaker and sort of anoint his chosen people to run. What do you think about that?
I think that would be the only thing that could deter him from running would be to be persuaded that he would lose. And so he would try to avoid the embarrassment of that. But I don't know that Donald Trump is the kind of person who surrounds himself with people who confront him with difficult truth. So I can't imagine, like Mark said, if he is still with us, I think he is going to be running.
Yeah.
I would say, Jason, that only people who don't know Donald Trump, and I don't know him that well, but I've spent some time with him, would think that anyone would have that much influence over him, or that the prospect of him losing would deter him at all, because he really does, as Matt alluded to, I think believe what he wants to believe is true. And I think he was born a wealthy man surrounded by people who told him how smart he was and how all his ideas were genius. And long ago, he accepted that as his truth. And so, he thinks he's the right person to be president of the United States. If he could make himself king of the United States, he would do that.
Yeah. Well, we will have to leave it there, and we'll all be watching over the next few years to see what happens. Mark Bowden, Matthew Teague, thank you so much for your time and for sharing this book with us and giving us some insight into what was going on that none of us would have known otherwise with the last election.
Thank you, Tracy.
Appreciate it.
And as always, we want to thank the author events team at the Free Library, Andy Cahan, Laura Kovacs, and Jason Freeman. Thanks to all of them for bringing all of us together, as they so often do. Thanks to all of you for joining us this evening. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation. Stay safe, stay warm, and we'll see you next time. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.